So, opportunity for some discussion, questions, answers. If anybody is in discomfort, you'd like to sit at the back. There's still some chairs there at the back if someone would like to change posture. So, does anybody have anything they would like to talk about, ask, tell me, teach me?
I had one issue come up recently, and this was Vajrayana teaching of they were saying that if in Theravada, if you have sense desire, you're afraid of it. So you try to renounce your desire. But in Vajrayana, that instead of being afraid of desire, they take the desire and they transform it. And therefore, you shouldn't give up, drugs. You shouldn't give up sex. You shouldn't give up alcohol. And instead, you should engage in those things. And by engaging in them, you're transforming your desire. And thereby, this is Dharma that is, they call the third turning of the wheel. The first turning was appropriate in that age, but in this age, the third turning of the wheel is more appropriate. And therefore, you should drink alcohol so long as you're not controlled by it. So I sat very quietly while I was listening to this.
But this is a lay teacher.
Yes, this is a lay teacher.
Yeah, I don't think monks teach that. Vajrayana monks don't teach that.
Well, I thought too that the monks wouldn't be teaching or doing that either. I mean, they have tantric sex and things like this, or they have Chogram Rinpoche, who was always drunk, but
He was disrobed.
right. This was a lay teacher teaching for lay people too.
Yeah, I mean it's that's like we're the small vehicle. I mean, people always are more attracted to that kind of teaching. Many years ago, as I recall, there was a meeting at Dharamsala with monks of all the different traditions, and there'd been a number of very damaging scandals in Tibetan Buddhist communities in America. And this topic was brought up, and I can't recall exactly, but it's something like the Dalai Lama said, the teachers say that these tantric sexual practices, are available to someone who can have the same feeling with having sex and eating excrement. And he said, "Is there anybody?" He asked all the Tibetan monks, "Are any of you at that level yet?" And none of them would lifted their hands. So, I mean, there are different. I don't want to denigrate this particular teacher because I don't know his own understanding, and certainly I don't agree. And I was speaking a little bit about faith just now, and I put my faith in the Lord Buddha and the teachings found in the Pali Canon and in my teachers, enlightened teachers in this tradition. And I don't know whether it's possible for someone to transform sexuality and drunkenness into very high spiritual attainments. I'm not so wise that I would be able to say it's absolutely impossible, but it doesn't seem likely to me. And I certainly don't think it's a practice that many people could make use of. I think teaching 100 people, it just would make sense to point out all the dangers of drinking alcohol rather than encouraging people to try to drink alcohol without it controlling them. Just seems a far, you know, on this very, on the level of pragmatism and just quality of life in families and in communities. I think that the Theravada teachings are a lot more sensible and practical, to my view. But again, some of this sort of emotionally toned language, you know, afraid of sensual desires. I mean, I don't think that there's anywhere in which we're taught to be afraid of desire as such, but we're taught to understand and we're taught to learn from our experience and to understand and to experience directly the nature of wholesome and unwholesome dhammas and those things which lead to peace and understanding and wisdom and those actions, those thoughts, those emotions that lead away from it. And so it's a practice of abandonment and cultivation. There is a famous, you know, well-known sutta in which a nun fell in love with Venerable Ananda. Venerable Ananda was very popular with the ladies, and he, the nun pretended that she was ill and asked whether Venerable Ananda would be kind enough to come and give her a teaching. So, of course, he went with other monks as attendants. He didn't go by himself. He gave a teaching which was both very subtle, very effective psychologically, but also in terms of the teaching that he gave that day. And he was he spoke in ways in which defilement can be used to overcome defilement. So certain kinds of conceit can be used on the path of practice. For instance, they're saying, well, you know, if he can do it, then I can do it. You know, which is, you know, based upon mistaken idea of self and other, and it's a sense of ego, if you like. But that beginning certain practices with defilement entails the burning up of that defilement within the practice. So that conceit is burned up within the practice based upon it, as it were, and certain kinds of cravings and so on. But the point being that the last point in the sutta, but as far as sexual desire is concerned, the Buddha taught us to cut it off completely. So this was a sort of in contrast to all the preceding clauses and points in which defilement can be used to overcome defilement. And it was at that point that the nun realized that Venerable Ananda knew that she was faking it, that she was in love with him, and so she became very ashamed and asked forgiveness, and which he gave her. So rather than sort of confronting her, you know, he did this very Buddhist way of giving a talk, which allowed her to see for herself where she was deluding herself, but being very clear. And this is one of the key texts in the Pali Canon, which confront or contradict that one. I mean, I don't think it's the whole story of Vajrayana teaching. There's so many different threads within the Vajrayana tradition, so it's not so clear cut as Vajrayana versus Theravada. But the Theravada position is is one in which sexual desire is undermining of the practice of Dhamma, and if for a lay person, then restraint and governance of sexual desire is counseled, and for monastics, those who are practicing in order to realize various stages of enlightenment in this lifetime, then the complete transcendence of sexual desire is demanded. So, I mean, there are cases of Venerable Chogyam Trungpa, who was, you know, was the great teacher of the age, and yet he, you know, he died of cirrhosis of the liver, and I think that his alcoholism is inspiring to very few, even in the Vajrayana tradition. So we can only speak from our own experience, for those of you who have, at periods of your life, taken drugs or drunk heavily, and now perhaps, I hope, have renounced that, and you compare the general level of awareness and clarity of mind and inner peace, I would suggest that it's not too difficult to see which the contrast there. Yeah, there are various interpretations of the fifth precept. One is to abstain from alcohol together, and the other one is to not get drunk. Is that right? Yeah. So there's the not get drunk interpretation, and there's the correct interpretation. No, I don't think there are any grounds or any texts anywhere that would support that interpretation that it's all right to drink a certain amount as long as you don't get drunk. I think that's sort of wishful thinking or somebody. I think if I mean, you know, supposed to be before I became a monk, I drank not too much, and I smoked dope and things like that, and, you know, just like most people in my generation. But for me, it was just when I started to meditate, it just became quite obvious to me it was a fork in the road. You have to make a choice. If you're sincere about developing sila, samadhi, panya, these two things are incompatible. I just can't see that there can be any question about that. Seeing how difficult it is to be mindful, how incredibly tough it is, and how many things there are that hinder and obstruct the path of practice, it would make sense, it makes sense to me, to at least eliminate all those elements that can be eliminated. You know, there are certain things you have no control over in your life, and the conditions in your city you live, the immediate environment or family conditions and so on. But there are certain areas of your life which are definitely detrimental to this practice, which are within your power to refrain from. Also, mentioning the silanusati practice, the recollection of sila. And when you hear a monk talking, you read the suttas, and you come across the five precepts, and for someone who keeps all five precepts well, merely hearing those five precepts one by one and what they mean, and knowing that you keep those precepts, that is a basis of incredible amount of a wonderful sense of well-being and joy in the heart. So it's not just, you know, you give up something, you know, so you're making a loss, you know, sort of a noble loss for the cause, but you're gaining something at the same time. And you know, as is well known, with the when once you start making exceptions with that fifth precept. It's like the little, and this is a tiny little hole in the dam, you know, it tends to get bigger and bigger. And if you're taking just a small amount of alcohol, then maybe it becomes a release way of relaxation, and it's quite normal in society, as you know. But then perhaps you go through some more difficult period in your life when everything, you lose your job, or there's some difficulty in your relationship, and you're just really depressed and upset and angry. And if your default means of dealing with stress and tension is a drink, then suddenly what is might have seemed quite a harmless habit can suddenly become quite a serious habit. You see, once you haven't cut off that area of escape, and instead of learning how to deal with stress and tension and negative emotions in a skillful, wise way, you've taken the easy way out with alcohol, then you don't have the resources to deal with the more difficult problems that can arise. But I think for me, a less reasoned or sort of more sort of emotional argument is that once you have this devotion to the Buddha, Sangha, the Buddha counsel keeping the five precepts. So it's like, you know, well, I'm a Buddhist. The Buddha told me not to drink, so don't drink. Stop, you know, what's more to talk about? You know, it's as simple as that. Ty's okay. Yeah. Araiku. So that's a two language question. Yes, okay. Dobbin, was that? What is the sound of silence? The sound of silence is a term coined by Venerable Ajahn Sumedho many years ago. I mean, it may have been found elsewhere, but in our tradition. And it was a meditation technique that Ajahn Sumedho developed and taught his students. It doesn't teach it so much these days, I think, but it's just that, you know, that kind of gentle hiss sound that you can hear. Don't hear it so much in Thailand, but I find if I go to England or in often it's quite sort of background sound that you can hear, and just using that as a meditation object. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've never really developed that meditation myself, but it's the case with most meditation objects that they are not exciting objects. You know, they are bland or very subtle objects, and so that danger of drowsiness is there in almost every meditation topic. And that's just one of the things that we are learning about, you know, about how our mind works, that the more that we are tuned into the external world and stimulation, then the more likely we are to become drowsy when we reduce the amount of stimulation. So it's a skill to be learned, but also to be recognizing that our intention in meditation is important. Sometimes or often people meditate with this kind of vague idea of peace. I want to be peaceful. I'm meditating to be peaceful. But people don't really know what peace means. I mean, it just means like not a lot going on. So as the amount of thoughts and things reduces, there's a sense, and you just settle back in it like it's kind of a warm blanket on a cold night, you know, and that's when the mind gets drowsy, because the intention is not for wakefulness and clarity of mind, but for some kind of emotional, fuzzy, pleasant feeling. So we have to be aware of what is it really that we're looking for, because if that's in the back of our mind, we just want that kind of pleasant, peaceful feeling of nothing going on disturbing us, then that's like practicing for heaven rather than practicing for liberation. So it's really important to be sustaining this sense of alertness and wakefulness right from the beginning, because that's what carries you through the meditation, even when it becomes more subtle, is just focusing on and really being aware of that sense of knowing and wakefulness. So that's your refuge in any meditation. If you get into a habit of getting sleepy in meditation, then one thing to do, if you like, make a fresh start, is just to start meditating for a very short period. Say if you sat for 30 minutes, so go right down to about 5 minutes and just say, I make a non-drowsy 5 minute meditation, and then try to make a non-drowsy 10 minute meditation, and then just work back up again. But just do these very short periods where you can be confident of being able to sustain that kind of alertness and clarity of mind.
Yeah. So, we can pass around. Yeah.
So, people, we've only got a few more minutes. So, before Ajahn Sumedho, of course, Simon and Garfunkel were using this term.
Oh,
yes, right.
One called and then we have to follow at least 227 precepts. This thing is indivisible. And you are at 5 precepts at least. The second one is we call Indriya Sila. Indriya means that to play important role in hearing, breathing, seeing all of the possession for the sixth sense. So you know what is going on while you're seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, tasting, or thinking. So this is a kind of zero to concern that what's going on. And the third one is called to consider what you are doing, just like eating, staying, sleeping, or anything for your daily life. That is what for. This is the thing of here is sila. Not only the precepts that you learn that not to do this, not to do that. That's the way to have the mindfulness. To understand it, what are you doing and how can you do? How can you deal with controlling that yourself and what should you do?
Maybe our poster is on the website. Yeah. Just a last question. We've got 5 minutes. We're going to stop in 5 minutes. So we've got a short question, a short answer. inside has been very quiet.
Can you clarify a very
Actually, it's the word, viriya parami. The word viriya is the, like vira in Thai, we say viraburut. It's like hero, so it's like heroic effort. That's what it means. It's so there are four kinds of effort. You know, so the effort to protect the mind from unwholesome, negative thoughts, emotions. All the various techniques and methods we use, from sense restraint, sila, and mindfulness, and so on, help to put forth this effort. And then there's the effort to deal with unwholesome dhammas that have already arisen, in the ways of dealing with them, putting forth that effort, and the effort to bring or to cultivate wholesome dhammas in the mind, and then the effort to care for and to cultivate further, or to bring to those wholesome dhammas to maturity. So I think this is really good reflection, you know, in daily life, where, you know, the opportunities for like formal meditation practice are limited. But if you think in terms of one of those four kinds of effort, you know, there's never a time when you can't put some kind of effort into one's life in one of those areas. So it's a really good thing to develop. And in fact, when the Buddha referring to his teaching, we call the Dhamma Vinaya or the Brahmacharya, he called it a Viryavada teaching. Is to say, is a teaching characterized by its emphasis on personal effort. And, for those of you who didn't hear that explanation, talking about sila, one of the ways of talking about sila found particularly in the Visuddhi Magga commentary is to divide, talk about four kinds of sila. So you have the sila of precepts, whether it's the precepts of the monk, or the five or eight precepts of the lay person. And then there's the sila of sense restraint. So taking care of your eyes and your ears and your nose and your tongue, not just following your eyes or whatever they want to look at, or just hearing whatever comes to the ears, but having a sense of care and choosing those things which are not poisonous to the mind, or things that leave a stain on the mind unnecessarily. And then the third area is that of sila in respect to the requisites for the monk, or the things that we use in our daily life, having a sense of moderation and care and attention to how we relate to our finances, to our house, our possessions, to technology and media, or how maintaining a wise relationship to all these things is a third area of sila. And the fourth is the area of livelihood, and choosing a livelihood which is at the very least does not entail breaking precepts or acting immorally or causing harm to others or to society, but ideally a livelihood which we can feel a sense of pride, and that we're doing something which is of value to society or to our fellow beings. So this is an expansion of the idea of sila. What the Venerable was trying to point he's trying to make, as I understood, was that we shouldn't just see precepts in terms of not doing this, not doing that, but it's a much richer, more comprehensive a term relating to the whole way we live in the world.